This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
It's my pleasure to welcome Chris Skinner. He is chairman at Financial Services Club and founder of Finicer. He's author of Digital Bank, Strategies to Launch or Become a Digital Bank, and his new book, which sounds fascinating, entitled Digital Human. Chris, welcome. How are you?
Yeah. Hi, Jason. I'm great. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you on the show. You're covering some really interesting topics, especially in your new book. It's fascinating how the world of banking is changing. Are the big banks and the money centers, are they in trouble? Are they going away? You know, you see all of these different models, which are quite interesting, that decentralize things, whether it be crypto or peer-to-peer lending platforms or, all sorts of blockchain-enabled smart contract services. Where are we going?
Well, I've been blogging every single day since the 1st of February 2007 about financial services and technology. And 10 years ago, I was talking a lot about banking as a service, with the idea that through cloud and application program interfaces and plug and play software, I could build my own bank using 1,000 specialist companies who do one thing really well, rather than having to deal with a big bank that does 1,000 things averagely. And
average is a compliment.
Yeah, tell me. Yeah. Well, finally, 10 years later, this has all become a reality. We're in the age of open-sourced financial services where, to a large extent, what the banks that are adapting to this environment are going to be very successful. And some banks don't get it and they will fail. But the banks overall will never disappear. I mean, although we want them to disappear in some cases, we've been saying for 25 years or more that banks don't serve customers well and they'll all die. That's not happened. They've got bigger.
Well, yes, they have gotten bigger, but they can thank the government central banking cartel and the corporate welfare bailouts that they all got during the Great Recession. But there are so many regulations that protect them. It's always been fascinating to me, Chris, how you'll hear big players, semi-monopolistic players in any industry, talk about how just the government has got to ease up on the regulations, when secretly they love the regulations because it keeps new entrants out of the market. I mean, scarcely in any other industry will you see such a lack of startup innovation as you will on Wall Street and in the banking world. There is just comparatively very little startup innovation there because the regulatory hurdles are giant. I mean, they are giant, aren't they?
I've spent a long time studying this stuff, and I can tell you categorically that there are two things that make the world go around: sex and money. And money is the control factor in our lives. It was invented by governments 10,000 years ago to control societies and make them civilized. And 400 years ago, or in fact more than that, governments invented banks as trusted stores of money. So the reason why the regulatory structure is such an overhead is because this is one of the core mechanisms of economies, societies, and civilizations and countries. And it's just as fundamental to our lives as, for example, pharmaceuticals. Now, would you want an unregulated market for drugs? I don't think so. Equally, do you want an unregulated market for money? Most people don't.
Well, I don't know. I'm a bit of a libertarian. There are other ways to regulate, quote unquote, things than having government do it. But we could get in the weeds for 3 days on that topic, so I don't want to do that. But let me just ask you, because you've got some great stuff to cover. First of all, on the first book, are you really saying that people can or should start a bank? I mean, what is there to that?
Well, what I'm getting at is that if you felt so inclined, you could get a lot of plug-and-play software from specialist companies, from Stripe to Square to TransferWise to Zopa to Sofi, and you could build your complete portfolio of lending, savings, investments, and credit using specialist companies. Most people just couldn't be bothered doing that and wouldn't feel comfortable doing that, so they would rather have a bank do that for them. And that's where I see the future role of the bank, that the banks that are adapting to the open source world of technology become curators of thousands of specialist firms that are doing things really well on a niche basis, rather than the banks trying to create that service themselves. And that's something that's a big challenge to the large banks, because they are historically control freaks, and the idea of suddenly opening up to being partners with lots of specialists is alien to them. But they have to get there, otherwise they won't survive.
I remember years ago, I purchased a stock in a couple of little banks in Orange County, California. They were business banks, very small. Really, they were doing private placement memorandums originally when I first came in contact with them. And I asked them, this was 20 years ago, mind you, or maybe 17 years ago, do you have online bill pay? And he said, yes, we have that. And, back then I was with the crooked, terrible, disgusting Wells Fargo. They were one of the early adopters of online bill pay, and their system became archaic over the years because updating legacy systems has its own challenges. But, I said, how much does that cost for you to enable that service with your bank? And he said, it's just an outside company that provides it. It was about $3,000 to set it up. And I thought, wow. Talk about assembling a bunch of little pieces where you don't have to hire a bunch of software engineers and spend millions of dollars. You can just buy that service. And that's really what you're saying. But what about the regulatory hurdles? I mean, there's still a bunch of regulation in banking, right?
There is, but you touched on a key point there, which is the challenge for particularly the larger financial institutions to deal with technology agility and change, because they have so much historical implementation of technologies that have never been changed, specifically and particularly the back office core systems. And the theme of the new book, Digital Human, is that we're going to be sideswiped by innovation, not from America or Europe, but from Asia and Africa. And in particular, a case study in the book is all about Ant Financial, which is part of the Alibaba empire in China. Ant Financial provides the Alipay wallet to Chinese citizens. And in 2016, they transacted $5.5 trillion through mobile wallets in China, not just through Alipay, but also WeChat Pay and other wallets. $5.5 trillion through mobile payments. Thousands and millions of transactions of tiny amounts, compared to a USA where in total the USA in the same year transacted $112 billion in mobile payments.
Right. And what's interesting is to look at the developing world, we really can learn some things from them, because they're almost forced to adopt these things because they don't have the big bank infrastructure we have. So it's interesting, like their systems in a lot of ways are more democratic, aren't they?
Well, the key point here is that China, Asia, Africa, Latin America, most of those markets had nothing until about 15 to 20 years ago in terms of technology structure for financial services. Sure. And they've leapfrogged Europe and America as a result. So by way of example, Ant Financial is on their fifth generation systems architecture for a 14-year-old company. They mm-hmm. throw away their systems every 3 or 4 years and rebuild them. Imagine any JP Morgan or Wells doing
Never.
That. They don't. Yeah, never. And so what we have here is layers of technology in America and Europe upon layers of old technology, whilst these guys are just reimagining everything with today's technologies. So a key thing about Ant Financial for me that came out of visiting with them, and it's a 30,000-word case study in their new book, is that they have built an infrastructure for today's world where they do microloans, micro savings, micro investments, and micro payments, and they can handle 1 million transactions a second for 2 billion users.
Amazing.
It is absolutely incredible. And that's where the vision is coming from. It's not coming from Europe or America.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so tell us what's coming. The WeChat Pay, that's kind of like a Venmo and PayPal kind of concept. And Facebook has payments as well. But what else can we expect?
Well, the key thing we can expect is that gradually we're going to see the mobile wallet combined with cryptocurrencies, creating a world of real-time, almost no-cost financial services. That will be created through thousands of specialist startup companies from Silicon Valley to Tel Aviv to London to Shanghai and Hangzhou, building very specialized capabilities around the idea of value transfer through technology rather than through physical money. And money now is just data. And the guys that get the data are the guys who will win. And that's where, if you're stuck with legacy and you haven't got clean data, you're going to fail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Okay, so I asked you about what else can we expect. So we've got the mobile payments. That's a big deal, and that's a very handy system. I mean, it boggles my mind why we're still using checks 100 years later or 200 years later. It's amazing, whether they be checks written by an online bill pay computer or a handwritten check or one sent through your computer's printer, it's still the same very old-fashioned concept. What else, though? I mean, banks do a lot of different things. You know, they take deposits, they pay minuscule interest on deposits, they lend money, they provide various financial services. There's more to it than just mobile payments.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk a lot about how corporate and commercial and investment markets and asset management and fund management will change. And equally, we could talk a lot about other technologies like biometrics, artificial intelligence, deep learning, machine learning, which are all incredibly important. But probably the number one most critical breakthrough that will come through the next decade is a digital identity scheme. And it's ludicrous today that to open an account, you have to go through a physical meeting with utility bills and a driving license or passport to prove that you exist. In fact, recently, I went to the bank to open an account for my kids with my wife, and my wife was told by the bank manager that she doesn't exist because she doesn't pay any utility bills and her passport had expired. Of course she exists.
Right. You know,
she's sitting next to me in the office. Yeah. So a digital identity scheme for everyone on the planet is already underway through the United Nations and the World Bank. And if we can crack that one, and there's hundreds of startups focused on using distributed ledger blockchain technologies to do this as well, if we can crack that one, then I think you'll see a complete flourishing of new ideas, because it's the hardest thing right now to do to recognize someone digitally and be able to trust that it really is them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Very interesting. So when it comes to the world of digital human and all of the things that you talk about in that book, it goes way beyond banking and financial services, right?
It does. The new book comes out in March, and it's actually the culmination of the success I've had with the previous books that's led me to travel the world and literally see almost every country on the planet. I spend a lot of time in the air traveling, and I've learned a lot through that, because when I'm visiting cities, I tend to go to museums or to go and explore the country and its history. And out of that, I realized that we are currently living in the fourth revolution of humanity. The first was becoming human, the second was becoming civilized, the third was becoming industrial. Today, we're becoming digital. And for the first time ever in the history of humanity, every single human on the planet can connect with every other human on the planet in real time, immediately, and transfer and transact and talk. That's never happened before, and it's transforming the way we make business, the way we make relationships, the way we make love. It's a massive fundamental shift in humanity that's not an evolution, it's a revolution of everything that's going on in this world. And a lot of people don't recognize that. They think it's just banking as usual or finance as usual with technology. It's not. It's a fundamental shift in humanity.
Talk to us more, though, about what that means. I mean, it constantly amazes me how many people like yourself, you know, we are, 6,000-7,000 miles apart, you and I, right now. How many people every day I communicate with all over the planet. This podcast, for example, has listeners in 165 countries. That is shocking. I mean, that is truly amazing. It's an amazing time to be alive, as I always say. But what else does that mean when you drill down on that a little more? I mean, a lot of people sort of take this for granted already.
Yeah, and I think a lot of particularly millennials and younger generation, not getting ageist here because I'm reasonably old, but it amazes me how these days you can have people who can create a media channel on YouTube that's more influential than NBC and CNN because they have so many subscribers and followers and can change people's mindset just by being one guy in a bedroom. That's something that's fundamentally shifted. The fact that I blog every day and have been doing that for over a decade, and it doesn't cost me anything, but I have a voice in a marketplace that's hearing me every day globally, is incredibly transformational. You know, I left my last company in 2002, and I didn't know what to do. And if I'd used traditional media and traditional structures to do what I'm doing today, it would cost me something like $10 million a year. It cost me nothing. because I'm doing it through the network. Yeah. And that is the fundamental shift, that you can build an entrepreneurial world with zero startup costs and suddenly become a unicorn overnight just because it's viral through the network connecting everyone on the planet.
I mean, the fact that you don't have the burden of needing an FCC license, well, that's the U.S., the Federal Communications Commission, and all of these other things, you know, you can cuss and swear and be explicit on the internet. You know, it just, there are some signs of real problems, though. As good as it is, companies like Facebook and Google scare me. Twitter, they are censoring things. They're all left-leaning. They, you know, and I'm not making a political statement. I'm just saying, look, it's scary that they censor things, and we don't know what we don't know. Like I always say, you can't hear the dogs that don't bark. You don't know what you don't see in your news feed. Recently, some undercover videos came out about Twitter ghosting people. I think that's what they call it. They will not show their tweets to other people if they're about Donald Trump, for example. Positively about Trump, I guess. They love to have the negative stuff. This is pretty scary stuff. I think these companies, as much as I hate regulation, maybe need to be regulated like utilities, or their algorithms need to become public so we know what they do. Nobody knows. It's just unbelievable what a secret it is.
Well, here's the funniest thing, Jason, in that you know, in Europe, they have a problem with particularly Google and Facebook and fake news and having people in searches and then saying they have the right to be forgotten and trying to regulate these guys. Now, the thing about that is that you can quite easily find Facebook's headquarters and Google's headquarters. Where's Bitcoin's headquarters? Where's the cryptocurrency's headquarters? They don't have one.
Yeah.
There is no door to knock on to regulate. Mm-hmm. So the cryptocurrencies area is really interesting. And earlier on, you mentioned the libertarian idea of money without government. And that's what we created, democratization, decentralization, and distributed systems. And I'm quite for that. At the same time, I just feel that as money was created by government and banks were created by government, that they won't let that go in this digital revolution. They will find a way to bring that under control. How they do that, I have no idea, because there's no door to knock on. But I just believe.
I agree completely. Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, you know, like when we talk about banking, that you maybe ostensibly your specialty, or at least the start of this conversation today, what we didn't take into account in our discussion, at least not yet, is the massive power of the two most powerful entities the human race has ever known, governments and central banks, with their standing armies and their collusion together. And if you think about it, the product every government creates, the main product, the flagship product of Apple, you could say, is the iPhone, right? The flagship product of every government is currency. That is their flagship product. They have other products and other things they do, but that's their main widget, I would argue. And they're not going to let go of the control of that easily. They're not going to allow a competitor like Bitcoin or Ethereum or Litecoin or anything to come in and just take that power, that awesome power of controlling and being able to inflate away the value of money or currency, I should say. They're not just going to relinquish that easily, at least, right?
No, and I take things like Ethereum and Ripple very seriously because they're being backed by corporate and government institutions. I take Bitcoin and Litecoin less seriously because they're being backed by democratized libertarians. And I just feel what's going to happen, and this is what all the banking community is betting on, is that there will be an implosion of the libertarian cryptocurrency world and a lot of money lost and a lot of people crying and seeing the blood on the wall. At the same time, you cannot have some of the things that everyone desires, like a blockchain that works in a public domain, without having a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin to support it. So what I think is interesting right now is I don't think we're going to see necessarily Bitcoin or some of the other currencies out there succeed, but eventually we will see one or two that rule them all. And that's why that this is truly an exciting time, because I totally buy into what everyone else is saying, that right now we're living through the equivalent of inventing the World Wide Web 20 years ago, where, you know, we didn't know what the outcome would be. And if we had, we would have invested very differently today with hindsight than we did, because we would have known that Amazon would be a behemoth and we would have known that Alibaba would have been massive. But we're going to see exactly the same with money and digital currencies and digital trade in the next 20 years, backed by a powerful distributed ledger and a powerful cryptocurrency. We just have to work out which one it is. And in my view, I think Ethereum is very likely to be the one, but I remain to be challenged and to find it something else.
Yeah. I mean, I think the winner is going to be one that's backed by the government and the central banks.
Well, that's why I say Ethereum.
Yeah. Right. Well, and that's what I was.
It's being incorporated by a lot of governments and central banks and big banks, big corporations.
Everybody loves these cryptos because they're decentralized, et cetera, et cetera. With Ethereum, for example, since that's the one you favor, tell us, if you would, how it's corporate and government-backed. And then also, would the powers that be, the governments or, you know, the central banks, I mean, it's hard to explain that cartel, but we all know it's there. Would they be able to control the value of it? Or is it really the market that's controlling the value of it? Because a great business plan for governments is to buy votes by promising free stuff and then inflate away the value of the debt. I mean, that's an awesome deal if you can get it. So, you know, will they be able to do that with like Ethereum or some other government or central bank backed crypto?
You've got to bear in mind there's something like 1,500 cryptocurrencies out there right now, of which there's a few that catch our eye because they have the most investment and capitalization. And so Ethereum is the second largest cryptocurrency behind Bitcoin. And the reason why I say it's gaining a lot of acceptance is that Microsoft supports it and have been offering it as a blockchain as a service, cloud-based capability to corporates for some time, and then created the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance that has people like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase involved. And as a result, it has a lot of credibility. There's equally other things like Ripple, which is used by a lot of banks to do cross-border exchange. But again, it's a very specific use for transacting in real time rather than using the SWIFT network, which is a network created in the 1970s to replace telex machines. So you've got a couple there that are really good examples of corporate acceptance and usage. Equally, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain is still very relevant and very important and has a large amount of capitalization and investment there. The difference is that the Bitcoin blockchain is completely public for anyone to see what's going on. With Ethereum, it's a hybrid public-private network blockchain distributed ledger. And that's the reason why corporates like it, because not everyone needs to see everything. And that's what the banks and governments and the corporates like. The idea that only those who need to know can see, and everyone else can just see maybe a anonymous summarized version of those transactions. That's what they like.
Yeah, really interesting. We talked about the control of the banking, the banks, the government, the people. I mean, you know, that's all sort of old information unless you have something to add to that. But there's a lot of talk about seeing blockchain in financial services. When will we see it really used in commerce? For all of this hype and all of this talk, Chris, it seems like it's slow to come. You know, there's just not, it's just a speculative frenzy mostly. Or am I wrong about that?
To an extent wrong, in that you know, there are clear use cases, particularly in financial services, for blockchain. So a good example is Ripple, as I mentioned, for cross-border currency exchange. The Australian Stock Exchange has made a public statement that their clearing and settlement will be done through Digital Assets Holdings, which is Blythe Masters' startup company, a blockchain-based company. NASDAQ is using blockchain-based clearing and settlement, because in clearing and settlement in the back office of the large financial institutions, it's a massive overhead to do the reconciliation of transactions using human eyes and human hand, automate the whole thing through an algorithm on a ledger, and it makes it $20 billion saved every year. $20 billion is something that is not to be sniffed at. In trade finance, supply chain, payments, in digital identity, as I've mentioned, in lots of areas, there's going to be major change. And the biggest place to watch to see what's really happening is Dubai. Dubai, as a emirate in the United Arab Emirates, has committed that all of their governmental documentation will be digitalized through distributed ledgers by 2020. All visas, all government contracts, all citizens' benefits and payments, everything in Dubai will be on a distributed ledger blockchain structure by 2020. They're leading the world. Watch that space.
Mm-hmm. What about South Korea, though, and them saying that, you know, everybody's going to lose their money in these cryptos? And what about the forces that would stomp this out?
Well, you've got to separate cryptocurrency speculation from blockchain and distributed ledger technology.
I agree completely. And that's what a lot of these speculators aren't doing, I would argue. They're throwing their money at this stuff, saying, you try to argue with them and say, well, you know, look at all these forces that don't like this. They're very powerful. And then they'll say, well, the blockchain, this and that. But that's not, these are different things. You know, just because one came with the other and brought it to the world's attention doesn't mean it's the same thing.
Yeah, and a lot of these things were bubbling around well before Bitcoin arrived in 2008, and that, you know, encrypted currencies and transfers has been something that technologists have been trying to develop for the last 30 years. Equally, you can have a distributed ledger structure without a cryptocurrency, such as R3 Corda, but equally, many of them do use cryptocurrencies to enable value transactions and transfers with trust. But the cryptocurrency craze came around, I guess, because people were seeing their friends and their friends of friends and their friends of friends of friends making thousands of dollars from putting a few bucks into Bitcoin a year ago. That may continue. And
it may not.
Well, I personally claim that it's not a bubble and it's not a fraud. And I think for the next 2 or 3 years, you will continue to see cryptocurrencies rise in value, mainly because we have untapped potential here that's in early days, as in pre-WWW of the internet era. So by the time we get to understand how the hell these things are going to pan out, I think you'll see the value of current cryptocurrencies, particularly the major ones, and specifically the ones I've been talking around, going up maybe tenfold in the next couple of years. But then it'll plateau, then it'll start to play out, and then we'll see what is really the game. And I keep coming back to saying it's all speculative, but one or two or three of these currencies will end up ruling them all and will be the way in which we run the world tomorrow. And that's the reason why everyone's getting engaged.
Yeah, it's just nobody knows, you know, when you're chasing a speculative frenzy, where the peak is and where the trough is. Just
but
nobody
go back
knows.
Go back to the 1990s, Jason, and you know, if you invested in Friends Reunited or in the alternatives to Amazon, you wasted your money and you got burned. But if you'd invested in Amazon then you made a mint. So that's why everyone's excited.
Yeah, right. You just don't know which one's going to be the winner. Maybe none of them will.
There may still be one to come.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, I think it'll be the one that's really put out by the central bank. You know, the one the Fed creates will be the one. That'll be the winner.
But just to clearly illustrate this space, right. And this is what digital human is about. The subtext of digital human is we're in the fourth revolution of humanity where everyone's included. Mm-hmm. So the first revolution was becoming human, which is covered really well in the book Sapiens by Yuval Harari.
I love that book. That's one of my favorite all-time books, Sapiens. And awesome. And his next one, what's the name of it? Forgive me. Homo Deus. Yeah, that's awesome too.
Homo Deus. But you may remember in Sapiens that the key reason why we became the dominant form of human on Earth is because we could share beliefs. Mm-hmm. And that's a fundamental of humanity, sharing beliefs.
Right.
The second revolution was becoming civilized, where we invented money, which enabled us to trade without bartering. The mm-hmm. third revolution was becoming industrial, where we invented banks so we could do cross-border trade globally.
Right.
The fourth revolution is this one becoming digital, mm-hmm. and we need to have something that goes along with money, banking, and share beliefs, mm-hmm. and that is digital value transfer. And that's why cryptocurrencies are so important.
Yeah, very, very interesting stuff. We will see where it all goes. Hey, Chris, I got one more question for you. I mentioned this recently on the show, and one of our clients, real estate investor client, sent a link to an app. And you mentioned at the beginning of this that the blockchain will change how we love. You said it would change how we live and transact and everything. You know, that's more apparent. But you said it would change how we love.
The link. Yeah. The link was to the consent app.
Yes, exactly.
So, yes, there you go. I agree to have sex. Okay.
Yeah. Let's go. Unbelievable. So is that what you meant when you said this, or what did you mean?
What I mean is the two things that drive humanity is sex and money. Mm-hmm. Money controls how we can live our lives, whether we have a great life or a bad life. If you don't have any money, you're going to have a much harder life than those who have a lot of money. And equally, money was invented 10,000 years ago to allow people to have intimacy with the goddess on Earth, Ishtar, which is why it was created, to enable us to have sex. And if you look at every technological revolution ever in history, it's been driven by pornography and sex, basically. And so right now, you know, robotics is being driven by sex robots, virtual reality by, you know, access to porn and through virtual reality. And that's what is key to understanding the triggers that drive change. So the cryptocurrency is aligned to these markets involved in intimacy are the ones that will actually drive change.
That's very interesting. You know, that is an incredibly powerful human need. I always say that, you know, after you have food, clothing, shelter, and, you know, the basics, then that's the next thing on the hierarchy, right? Whether Maslow
it's
says it or not.
For me.
Yeah, right.
not that my wife wants to hear that.
Yeah, right. But it's right up there, certainly. And it does drive a lot of innovation. There's no question about it. So the consent by the blockchain, oh my God.
I should just finish. I was talking about this the other day with a friend. And he sent me the link to the Avenue Q song, "The Internet is for Porn." And if you haven't seen it, then go watch it.
But interestingly, social media surpassed that industry. You know, that social media is the biggest industry, from what I understand, on the internet now. It used to be porn, but now social media has taken it over, which one thing might lead to the other, admittedly, because there's a lot of dating that goes on in social media. But any comment on that?
Well, I mean, I was very early into the social media usage, and that's another reason why, going back to what we were saying about the whole planet being connected and it's free, became compelling, because since we had Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., it's been really easy to get access to everything. In terms of how the other parts of the markets, in terms of payments and access to dating, comes into social media, we've seen that coming through as well. I mean, there's quite a lot of access to relationships through media. And one of the greatest things I've seen is in China, which is a peer-to-peer loan company, a bit like Sophie or Prosper or Lending Club, that when you take out the loan, you have to send them a picture of your naked self. And if you don't pay back the loan, they will release it publicly online.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. Oh, boy, that's amazing. That's amazing. Oh, wow. Well, with that, I guess we'll leave it there. Chris, give out your website. Tell people where they can find your excellent blog.
Yeah, you can find me at thefinancer.com, F-I-N-A-N-S-E-R. I blog there every single day, and I've been doing that for 11 years.
Chris Skinner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.